Them Massimos will always be a step ahead. That's the kind of people they are. People with connections. We're just a couple of poor folks living on a lucky fortune. And I guess that'll have to be enough. As we went up the steps of our shitty little cabin, there come one final trumpet blast from the fine big house across the lake. Wah! Made my head ache, it did. Howard Gamache told me that last firework was called the Rooster of Destiny. He said he'd seen videos of them on YouTube, but always with people talking Chinese in the background.
How this Massimo gentleman got it into this country is a mystery to me, Howard said. This was about a month later, toward the end of last summer, when I finally got up enough ambition to make the drive up to his two-story wigwam on Indian Island and tell him what happened. How we give them a good battle, but still come off on the short end when all was said and told.
It's no mystery to me, I said. His friends in China probably threw it in as an extra with his last load of opium. You know, little gift to say, thanks for doing business with us. Have you got anything that'll top it? I mean, Ma's awful depressed, Mr. Gamache. She don't want to compete next year. But I was thinking, if there was anything, you know, the topper to top all toppers, well, I'd pay as much as $1,000. It'd be worth it just to see my Ma smiling on 4th of July night. Howard sat on his back steps with his knees sticking up around his ears like a couple of boulders. God, what a mighty man he was, and thought about it, cogitated on it. Judged his way around it. At last he said,
I have heard rumors.
Rumors about what?
About a special something called Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind from a fellow I correspond with on the subject of gunpowder amusements. His native name is Shining Path, but mostly he goes by Johnny Parker. He's a Cayuga Indian. And he lives near Albany, New York. I could give you his email address, but he won't reply unless I email him first and tell him you're safe.
Will you do that, I asked?
Of course,
he said.
But first you must pay, he big wampum pale face. $50 should do it.
Money passed from my small hand to his big one. He emailed Johnny Shining Path Packer, and when I got back to the lake, and sent him an email of my own, he answered right back. But he wouldn't talk about what he called CE4, except in person. Claimed the government read all Native American emails as a matter of course. I didn't have no argument with that. I bet those suckers read everybody's email. So we agreed to meet, and along about the 1st of October last year, I went up. Of course, Ma wanted to know what sort of errand would take me all the way to upstate New York, and I didn't bother telling her no made-up story, because she always sees through 'em and has since I was knee-high to a collie. She just shook her head. Go on, if it'll make you happy, she said. But you know they'll come back with something even bigger. We'll be stuck listening to that eye-tie cock-knocker blowing his trumpet. Well, maybe, I said. But Mr. Shining Pass says this is the firework to end all fireworks. As you now see, that turned out to be nothing but the truth. I had a pretty drive, and Johnny Shining Path Parker turned out to be a nice fella. His wigwam was in Green Island, where the houses are almost as big as the Massimo's 12 pines. And his wife made one hell of an enchilada. I ate three with that hot green sauce and got the shits on the way home. But since that ain't part of the story and I can see Adele's getting impatient again, I'll leave it out. All I can say is thank God for handy wipes. CE4 would be a special order, Johnny said. The Chinese make only 3 or 4 a year. And out of Mongolia or someplace like that, with his snow 9 months out of the year and the babies are purportedly raised with wolf cubs. Such explosive devices are usually shipped to Toronto. I guess I could order one and bring it in from Canada myself, although you'd have to pay for my gas and my time. If I got caught, I'd probably end up in Leavenworth as a terrorist. Jesus! I don't want to get you in no trouble like that, I said.
Well, I'm exaggerating a bit, maybe, he said. But CE4's one hell of a firework. Never been one like it. I couldn't give you your money back if your pal across the lake happened to have something to beat it, but I'd give you back my profit on the deal. That's how sure I am.
Besides, Cindy Shining Path Parker said, Johnny loves an adventure. Would you like another enchilada, Mr. McCausland? I passed on that, which probably kept me from exploding somewhere in Vermont, and for a while I almost forgot the whole thing. Then, just after New Year's, we're getting close now, Ardell, don't that make you happy? I got a call from Johnny. If you want that item we were discussing last fall, he said, I've got it, but it'll cost you $2,000. I sucked in breath. That's pretty steep.
I can't argue with you there, but look at it this way. You white folks got Manhattan for $24, and we've been looking for payback ever since. He laughed and then said, but speaking seriously now, and if you don't want it, that's fine. Maybe a buddy across the lake would be interested.
Don't you ever, I said. He laughed harder at that.
I have to tell you, this thing is pretty awesome. I've sold a lot of fireworks over the years, and have never seen anything remotely like this.
Like what, I asked. What is it?
You have to see for yourself, he said. I have no intention of sending you a picture over the Internet. Besides, it doesn't look like much until it's, in use. If you want to roll on up here, I can show you a video.
I'll be there, I said, and 2 or 3 days later I was. Sober? And shaved, and with my hair combed. Now listen to me, you two. I ain't going to make excuses for what I done, and you can leave Ma out of it. I was the one that got the damn thing, and I was the one who set it off. But I am going to tell you that the CE4 I saw in that video Johnny showed me, and the one I set off last night, wasn't the same. The one in the video was a lot smaller. I even remarked on the size of the crate mine was in, when Johnny and me put it in the back of the truck.
Well, they sure must have put a lot of packing in there, I said. I guess they wanted to make sure nothing would happen to it in shipping, Johnny said.
He didn't know either, you see. Cindy Shining Path asked if I didn't want to at least open the crate and have a look, make sure it was the right thing. But it was nailed up tight all over, and I wanted to get back before dark on account of my eyes ain't as good as they used to be. But because I come here today determined to make a clean breast of it, I have to tell you that wasn't the truth. Evening is my drinking time, and I didn't want to miss any of it. That's the truth. I know that's kind of a sad way to be, and I know I have to do something about it. I guess if they put me in jail, I'll get the chance, won't I?
Ma and me unnailed the crate the next day and took a look at what we'd bought. This was at the house in town, you understand, because we're talking January and colder than a witch's tit. There was some packing material, all right, Chinese newspapers of some kind, but not nearly so much as I expected. The CE4 was probably 7 feet on the square and looked like a package done up in brown paper, only the paper was kind of oily. And so heavy it felt more like canvas. The fuse was sticking out the bottom.
"Do you really think it will go up?"
Ma asked. "Well," I said, "if ours don't, what's the worst that can happen?"
"We'll be out $2,000," Ma said. "But that ain't the worst. The worst would be it rises up 2 or 3 feet and then fizzles into the lake, followed by that young Italian who looks like Ben Affleck, blowing his trumpet."
We put it in the garage, and there it stayed until Memorial Day when we took it out to the lake. I didn't buy nothing else of a firework nature this year, not from Pop Anderson and not from Howard Gamache either.
We was all in on the one thing. It was CE4 or bust. All right, here we are at last night. 4th of July of 2015. Never been nothing like it on Abenaki Lake, and I hope there never will be again. We knew it had been a goddamn dry summer, of course we knew. But that never crossed our minds, why would it? We were shooting over the water, weren't we? What could be safer? All the Massimos was there and having fun, playing their music, playing their games, and cooking weenies on about 5 different grills, and swimming near the beach and diving off the float. Everyone else was there, too, on both sides of the lake. There was even some at the north and south ends where it's all swampy. They were there to see this year's chapter of the great 4th of July arms race. Itis versus Yankees. Dusk drew down, and finally, the wishing star come out, like she always does, and those electric torches at the end of the Massimo dock popped on like a couple of spotlights. Out onto it struts Paul Massimo, flanked by his 2 grown sons, and goddamn if they weren't dressed like for a fancy country club dance. Father in a tuxedo, sons in white dinner jackets with red flowers in the lapels, the Ben Affleck-looking one wearing his trumpet down low on his hip like a gunslinger. I looked around and seen the lake was lined with more folks than ever before. Must have been at least 1,000. They'd come expecting a show, and those Massimos was dressed to give 'em one, while Ma was in her usual house dress, and I was in a pair of old jeans and a T-shirt that says, "Kiss me where it stinks. Meet me in Lincoln."
"He ain't got no boxes, Alden," Ma said. "Why is that?"
I just shook my head because I didn't know. Our single firework was already at the end of our dock covered with an old quilt, had been there all day. Massimo held out his hand to us, polite as always, telling us we should start. I shook my head and held out mine right back, as if to say, "Nope, after you this time, Monsieur." He shrugged and made a twirling gesture in the air, sort of like when the ump is saying it's a home run. About 4 seconds later, the night was filled with uprushing trails of sparks, and fireworks started to explode all over the lake, in starbursts and sprays. Multiple canister blasts that shot out flowers and fountains, I don't know what all. Ma gasped.
"Why, that dirty dog! He went and hired a whole fireworks crew, professionals!"
And yes, that's just what he done. He must have spent $10,000 or $15,000 on that 20-minute sky show, what with the double Excalibur and the wolf pack that come near the end. The crowd on the lake was whooping and hollering to beat the band, banning on their car horns and cheering and screaming. The Ben Affleck-looking one was blowing his trumpet hard enough to give him a brain hemorrhage, but you couldn't even hear him over the gunnery practice going on in the sky, which was lit up, bright as day, and in every color. Sheets of smoke rose from where the fireworks crew was setting off their goods down on the beach, but none of it blew across the lake. It blew toward the house instead, toward 12 Pines. You could say, I should have noticed that. But I didn't. Ma didn't either. Nobody did. We was too gobsmacked. Massimo was sending us a message, you see. It's over. Don't even think about it next year, you poor-ass Yankees. There was a pause, and I was just deciding he'd shot his load, when up goes a double gusher of sparks, and the sky filled with a great big burning boat, sails and all. I knew from Howard Gamash what that one was, too, an excellent junk. That's a Chinese boat. When it finally went out and the crowd around the lake stopped going bananas, Massimo signaled to his fireworks boys one last time, and they sparked up an American flag on the beach. It burned red, white, and blue, and threw off fireballs while somebody played America the Beautiful through the sound system. Finally, the flag burned out to nothing but orange cinders. Massimo was still at the end of his dock, and he held his hand out to us again, smiling, as if to say, "Go on and shoot whatever paltry shit you got over there, McCausland, and we'll be done with it. Not just for this year, but for good." I looked at Ma. She looked at me. Then she slatted whatever's left of her drink, we was drinking moonquakes last night, into the water and said, "Go on. It probably won't amount to a piss hole in the snow, but we bought that damn thing, might as well set her off." I remember how quiet it was. The frogs hadn't started up again yet, and the poor old loons had packed it in for the night, maybe for the rest of the summer. There were still plenty of people standing at the water's edge to see what we had, but a lot more was going back to town, like fans will, when the tea was getting blown out and has no chance of coming back. I could see a chain of lights all the way down Lake Rod that hooks up with Highway 119 into Pretty Bitch, the one that eventually takes you to TI-90 in Chester's Mill. I decided if I was going to do it, I ought to make a fair show of it. If it misfired, the ones that were left could laugh as much as they wanted. I could even put up with the goddamn trumpet, knowing I wouldn't have to listen to it blow it at me next year, because I was done, and I could see from her face that Ma felt the same. Even her boobs seemed to be hanging their heads, but maybe that was just because she left off her bra last night. She says it pinches her terrible. I whipped off that piece of quilt like a magician doing a trick. And there was the square thing I'd bought for $2,000, probably half of what Massimo paid for just his excellent junk alone, all wrapped in its heavy, canvassy paper, with the short, thick fuse sticking out the end. I pointed to it, then pointed to the sky. Them three dressed up Massimo standing at the end of their dock laughed, and the trumpet blew. I lit the fuse, and it started to spark. I grabbed Ma and pulled her back in case the friggin' thing should explode on the launching pad. The fuse burned down to the box, then disappeared. Fucking box just sat there. The Massimo with the trumpet raised it to his lips, but before he could blow it, fire kind of squashed out from under the box. And up it rose, slow at first, then faster as more jets, I guess they was jets, caught fire. Up and up, 10 feet, then 20, then 40. I could just make out the square shape against the stars. It made 50, everyone craning their necks to look. And then it exploded, just like the one in the YouTube video Johnny Shining Path Packer showed me. Me and Ma cheered. Everyone cheered. The Massimos only looked perplexed and maybe, hard to tell from our side of the lake, a little contemptuous. It was like they was thinking, an exploding box? What the fuck is that? Only the CE4 wasn't done. When people's eyes adjusted, they gasped in wonder, for the paper stuff was unfolding and spreading, even as it began to burn every color you ever saw, and some you never did. It was turning into a goddamn flying saucer. It spread, and spread, like God was opening his own holy umbrella. And as it opened, it began shooting off fireballs every which way. Each one exploded and shot off more, making a kind of rainbow over that saucer. I know you two have seen cell phone video of it. Probably everybody who had a phone was making movies of it, which I don't doubt will be in evidence at my trial. But I'm telling you, you had to be there to fully appreciate the wonder of it. Ma was clutching my arm. "It's beautiful," she said. "But I thought it was only 8 feet across. Isn't that what your Indian friend said?" It was, but the thing I'd unleashed was 20 feet across, and still growing when it popped a dozen or more little parachutes to keep it elevated while it shot off more colors and sparklers and fountains and flash bombs. It was maybe not so grand as Massimo's fireworks show in the altogether, but grander than his excellent junk. And, of course, it came last. That's what people always remember, don't you think? What they see last? I seen the Massimo staring up at the sky. Their jaws hung down like dolls on busted hinges, looking like the purest goddamn idiots that ever walked the earth. And she started to dance. The trumpet was dangling down Ben Affleck's hand like he'd forgotten he had it.
"We beat 'em!" Ma screamed at me, shaking her fist. "We finally did it, Alden! Look at 'em! They're beat, and it was worth every fucking penny!"
She wanted me to dance with her, but I seen something I didn't much care for. The wind was pushing that flying saucer eastwards across the lake, toward 12 Pines. Paul Massimo seen the same thing, and pointed at me, as if to say, "You put it up there, you bring it down while it's still over the water." Only I couldn't, of course. And meanwhile, the goddamn thing was still blowing its wad, shooting off rockets and cannonades and swirly fountains like it would never stop. Then, I had no idea it was going to happen because the video Johnny Shining Path showed me was silent. It started to play music. Just 5 notes over and over. Doo-dee-doo-dum-dee. It was the music the spaceship makes in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So it's toodly-doing, toodly-deen, and that's when the goddamn saucer caught a fire. I don't know if that was an accident or if it was supposed to be the final effect. The parachutes holding it up, they caught too. And the Hallmaster started to sink. At first, I thought it'd go down before it ran out of lake to land in. Maybe on the Massimo swimming float, which would have been bad, but not the worst. Only just then, a stronger gust of wind blew up, as if Mother Nature herself was tired of the Massimos. Or maybe it was just that fucking trumpet the old girl was tired of. Well, you know how that place got its name, and them dozen pines was plenty dry. There was 2 of them on either side, a long front porch, and those were what our CE-4 crashed into. Them trees went up right away, looking sort of like the electric torches at the end of the Massimo's dock, only bigger. First the needles, then the branches, then the trunks. Massimo started running every which way, like ants when somebody kicks their heel. A burning branch fell on the roof over the porch, and pretty soon that was burning merry hell, too. And all the while that little tootlin' tune went on, doo-dee-doo-dum-dee. The spaceship tore into 2 pieces. Half of it fell on the lawn, which wasn't so bad, but the other half floated down on the main roof, still shooting off a few final rockets, one of which crashed through an upstairs window, lighting the curtains afire as it went. Ma turned to me and said, "Well, that ain't good." "Now," I said, "looks pretty poor, don't it?" She said, "I guess you better call the fire department, Alden. In fact, I guess you better call 2 or 3 of them. There's going to be cooked woods from the lake to the Castle County line." I turned to run back to the cabin and get my phone, but she caught my arm. There was this funny little smile on her face. "Before you go," she said, "take a glance at that." She pointed across the lake. By then, the whole house was afire, so there wasn't no trouble seeing what she was pointing at. There was no one on their dock anymore, but one thing got left behind. The goddamn trumpet. "Tell him it was all my idea," Ma said. "I'll go to jail for it, but I don't give a shit. Least we shut that friggin' thing up." "Say, Adele, can I have a drink of water? I'm as dry as an old chip."
Officer Benoit brought Alden a glass of water. She and Andy Clutterbuck watched him drink it down. A lanky man in chinos and a strap-style T-shirt, his hair thin and graying, his face haggard from lack of sleep and the previous night's ingestion of 60-proof moonquakes. At least no one got hurt, Alden said. I'm glad of that. And we didn't burn the woods down. I'm glad of that, too.
You're lucky the wind died, Andy said.
You're also lucky the fire trucks from all three towns were standing by, Adele added. Of course, they have to be on 4th of July nights, because there are always a few fools setting off drunken fireworks.
This is all on me, Alden said. I just want you to understand that. I bought the goddamn thing, and I was the one who fired it up. Ma had nothing to do with it. He paused.
I just hope Massimo understands that and leaves my Ma alone. He's connected, you know.
Andy said, that family has been summering on Abenaki Lake for 20 years or more, and according to everything I know, Paul Massimo is a legitimate businessman.
Yeah, Alden said, just like Al Capone.
Officer Ellis knocked on the glass of the interview room, pointed at Andy, cocked his thumb and little finger in a telephone gesture, and beckoned. Andy sighed and left the room.
Adele Benoit stared at Alden. I've seen some tall orders of shit flapjacks in my time, she said, and even more since I got on the cops, but this takes the prize.
I know, Alden said, hanging his head. I ain't making any excuses. Then he brightened.
But it was one hell of a show while it lasted. People won't never forget it.
Adele made a rude noise. Somewhere in the distance, a siren howled. Andy eventually came back and sat down. He said nothing at first, just looked off into space.
Was that about Ma? Alden asked.
It was your Ma, Andy said. She wanted to talk to you, and when I told her you were otherwise occupied, she asked if I would pass on a message. She was calling from Lucky's Diner, where she just finished having a nice sit-down brunch with your neighbor from across the lake. She said to tell you he was still dressed in his tuxedo, and it was his treat.
Did he threaten her? Alden cried. Did that son of a bitch?
Sit down, Alden. Relax.
Alden settled slowly from a half-risen crouch, but his hands were clenched into fists. They were big hands and looked capable of doing damage if their owner felt provoked.
Hallie also said to tell you that Mr. Massimo isn't going to press any charges. He said that two families got into a stupid competition, and consequently, both families were at fault. Your mother says Mr. Massimo wants to let bygones be bygones.
Alden's Adam's apple bobbed up and down, reminding Adele of a monkey on a stick toy she'd had as a child. Andy leaned forward. He was smiling in the painful way folks do, when they don't really want to smile, but just can't help it.
She said Mr. Massimo also wants you to know he was sorry about what happened with the rest of your fireworks.
The rest of them? I told you we didn't have nothing this year except
hush while I'm talking. I don't want to forget any of the message.
Alden hushed. Outside they could hear a second siren, then a third.
The ones in the kitchen, those fireworks. Your ma said you must have put the boxes too close to the wood stove. Do you remember doing that? I urge you to remember, Alden, because I have a deep desire to bring down the curtain on this particular shit show.
I guess I sort of do, Alden said.
I won't even ask why you had your stove going on a hot July night, because after 30 years in the policing business, I know drunks are apt to take any half-baked notion into their heads. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, Alden admitted. Drunks are unpredictable, and those boomquakes are deadly.
Which is why your cabin out there on Abenaki Lake is now burning to the ground.
Jesus Christ on a crutch!
I don't think we can blame this fire on the Son of God, Alden. Crutch or no crutch, were you insured?
Gory, yes, Alden said. Insurance is a good idea. I learned that when Daddy passed away.
Massimo was insured as well. Your mother told me to tell you that, too. She said the two of them agreed over bacon and eggs, that it all evens out. Would you agree with that?
Well, his house was a hell of a lot bigger than our cabin.
Presumably his policy will reflect the difference.
Andy stood up. I suppose there'll be some kind of hearing eventually, but right now you're free to go. Alden said thank you and left before they could change their minds. Andy and Ardell sat in the interview room looking at each other. Eventually, Ardell said, "Where was Mrs. McCausland when the fire broke out?" "Until Massimo came to treat her to lobster Benedict and home fries at Lucky's, right here at the station," Andy said. "Waiting to see if her boy was going to court or county jail, hoping for court so she could bail him out. Ellis said that when she and Massimo left, he had his arm around her waist, which must have been quite a reach considering her current girth." "And who do you think set the fire at the McCausland cabin?" "We'll never know for sure, but were I forced to guess, I'd say it was Massimo's boys before sunrise. Put some of their own unused fireworks next to the stove or right on top of it, and then stuffed that pearl full of kindling so it would burn nice and hot. Not much different from putting a bomb on a timer when you think about it."
"Damn,"
Ardell said. "What it comes down to is drunks with fireworks, which is bad, and one hand washing the other, which is good." Ardell thought about that, then puckered her lips and whistled the five-note melody from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. She tried to do it again, but began to laugh and lost her pucker. "Not bad," Andy said. "But can you play it on the trumpet?"
Thinking of Marshall Dodge. What better place to end a collection than with a story about the end of the world? I've done at least one sprawling book on this subject, The Stand, but here the focus is narrowed to little more than a pinprick. I don't have much to say about the story itself, other than that I was thinking about my beloved 1986 Harley Softail, which I've now put away and probably for good. My reflexes have slowed enough to make me a danger to myself and others when I'm on the road and doing 65. How I love that bike. After I wrote Insomnia, I rode it from Maine to California and remember an evening somewhere in Kansas, watching the sun set in the west while the moon rose huge and orange in the east. I pulled over and just watched, thinking it was the finest sunset of my life. Maybe it was. Oh, and Summer Thunder was written in a place much like the one where we find Robinson, his neighbor, and a certain stray dog named Gandalf.
Summer Thunder, read by Will Patton.
Robinson was okay as long as Gandalf was. Not okay in the sense of everything is fine, but in the sense of getting along from one day to the next. He still woke up in the night, often with tears on his face from vivid dreams where Diana and Ellen were alive. But when he picked Gandalf up from the blanket in the corner where he slept and put him on the bed, he could more often than not go back to sleep again. As for Gandalf, he didn't care where he slept. And if Robinson pulled him close, that was okay, too. It was warm, dry, and safe. He had been rescued. That was all Gandalf cared about. With another living being to take care of, things were better. Robinson drove to the country store 5 miles up Route 19, Gandalf sitting in the pickup's passenger seat, ears cocked, eyes bright, and got dog food. The store was abandoned. And of course it had been looted, but no one had taken the Yukonuba. After June 6th, pets had been the last thing on people's minds, so Robinson deduced. Otherwise, the two of them stayed by the lake. There was plenty of food in the pantry and boxes of stuff downstairs. He had often joked about how Diana expected the apocalypse, but the joke turned out to be on him. Both of them, actually. because Diana had surely never imagined that when the apocalypse finally arrived, she would be in Boston with their daughter, investigating the academic possibilities of Emerson College. Eating for one, the food would last longer than he did. Robinson had no doubt of that. Timlin said they were doomed. He never would have expected doom to be so lovely. The weather was warm and cloudless. In the old days, Lake Pocumtuck would have buzzed with powerboats and jet skis, which were killing the fish, the old-timers grumbled. But this summer, it was silent except for the loons. Only there seemed to be fewer of them crying each night. At first, Robinson thought this was just his imagination, which was as infected with grief as the rest of his thinking apparatus, but Timlin assured him it wasn't. "Haven't you noticed that most of the woodland birds are already gone? No chickadee concerts in the morning, no crow music at noon. By September, the loons will be as gone as the loons who did this. The fish will live a little longer, but eventually they'll be gone too, like the deer, the rabbits, and the chipmunks." About such wildlife, there could be no argument. Robinson had seen almost a dozen dead deer beside the lake road, and more beside Route 19, on that one trip he and Gandalf had made to the Carson Corners General Store, where the sign out front, "Buy your Vermont cheese and syrup here," now lay face down next to the dry gas pumps. But the greatest part of the animal holocaust was in the woods. When the wind was from the east, toward the lake rather than off it, the reek was tremendous. The warm days didn't help, and Robinson wanted to know what had happened to nuclear winter. "Oh, it'll come," said Timlin, sitting in his rocker and looking off into the dappled sunshine under the trees. "Earth is still absorbing the blow. Besides, we know from the last reports that the southern hemisphere, not to mention most of Asia, is sucked in beneath what may turn out to be eternal cloud cover. Enjoy the sunshine while we've got it, Peter." As if he could enjoy anything. He and Diana had been talking about a trip to England. Their first extended vacation since the honeymoon, once Ellen was settled in school. Ellen, he thought, who had just been recovering from the breakup with her first real boyfriend and was beginning to smile again. On each of these fine late summer, post-apocalypse days, Robinson clipped a leash to Gandalf's collar. He had no idea what the dog's name had been before June 6th. The mutt had come with a collar from which only a state of Massachusetts vaccination tag hung, and they walked the 2 miles to the pricey enclave, of which Howard Timlin was now the only resident. Diana had once called that walk snapshot heaven. Much of it overlooked sheer drops to the lake and 40-mile views into New York. At one point, where the road button-hooked sharply, a sign that read, "Mind Your Driving," had been posted. The summer kids, of course, called this hairpin Dead Man's Curve. Woodland Acres, private as well as pricey before the world ended, was a mile farther on. The centerpiece was a fieldstone lodge that had featured a restaurant with a marvelous view, a 5-star chef, and a beer pantry stocked with 1,000 brands. "Many undrinkable," Timlin said. "Take it from me." Scattered around the main lodge in various bosky dells were 2 dozen picturesque cottages, some owned by major corporations before June 6th put an end to corporations. Most of the cottages had still been empty on June 6th, and in the crazy 10 days that followed, the few people who were in residence fled for Canada, which was rumored to be radiation-free. That was when there was still enough gasoline to make flight possible. The owners of Woodland Acres, George and Ellen Benson, had stayed. So had Timlin, who was divorced, had no children to mourn, and knew the Canada story was surely a fable. Then in early July, the Bensons had swallowed pills and taken to their bed while listening to Beethoven on a battery-powered phonograph. Now it was just Timlin. "All that you see is mine," he had told Robinson, waving his arm grandly. "And someday, son, it will be yours." On these daily walks down to the acres, Robinson's grief and sense of dislocation eased. Sunshine was seductive. Gandalf sniffed at the bushes and tried to pee on everyone. He barked bravely when he heard something in the woods, but always moved closer to Robinson. The leash was necessary only because of the dead squirrels and chipmunks. Gandalf didn't want to pee on those. He wanted to roll in what was left of them. Woodland Acres Lane split off from the camp road where Robinson now lived the single life. Once the lane had been gated to keep looky-loos and wage slave rabble such as himself out, but now the gate stood permanently open. The lane meandered for half a mile through forest where the slanting, dusty light seemed almost as old as the towering spruces and pines that filtered it, past four tennis courts, skirted a putting green, and looped behind a barn where the trail horses now lay dead in their stalls. Timlin's cottage was on the far side of the lodge, a modest dwelling with four bedrooms, four bathrooms, a hot tub, and its own sauna. "Why did you need four bedrooms if it's just you?" Robinson asked him once. "I don't now, and never did," Timlin said. "But they all have four bedrooms, except for Foxglove, Yarrow, and Lavender. They have five. Lavender also has an attached bowling alley, all mod cons. But when I came here as a kid with my family, we peed in a privy. True thing." Robinson and Gandalf usually found Timlin sitting in one of the rockers on the wide front porch of his cottage, Veronica, reading a book or listening to his battery-powered CD player. Robinson would unclip the leash from Gandalf's collar and the dog, just a mutt, no real recognizable brand except for the spaniel ears, raced up the steps to be made a fuss of. After a few strokes, Timlin would gently pull at the dog's gray-white fur in various places, and when it remained rooted, he would always say the same thing. Remarkable. On this fine day in mid-August, Gandalf only made a brief visit to Timlin's rocker, sniffing at the man's bare ankles before trotting back down the steps and into the woods. Timlin raised his hand to Robinson in the how gesture of an old-time movie Indian. Robinson returned the compliment. "Want a beer?" Timlin asked. "They're cool. I just dragged them out of the lake." Would today's tipple be Old Shitty or Green Mountain Dew? "Neither. There was a case of Budweiser in the storeroom. The King of Beers, as you may remember. I liberated it." "In that case, I'll be happy to join you." Timlin got up with a grunt and went inside, rocking slightly from side to side. Arthritis had mounted a sneak attack on his hips 2 years ago, he had told Robinson, and not content with that, had decided to lay claim to his ankles. Robinson had never asked, but judged Timlin to be in his mid-70s. His slim body suggested a life of fitness, but fitness was now beginning to fail. Robinson himself had never felt physically better in his life, which was ironic considering how little he now had to live for. Timlin certainly didn't need him, although the old guy was congenial enough. As this preternaturally beautiful summer wound down, only Gandalf actually needed him, which was okay, because for now, Gandalf was enough. Just a boy and his dog, he thought. Said dog had emerged from the woods in mid-June, thin and bedraggled, his coat snarled with burdock stickers and with a deep scratch across his snout. Robinson had been lying in the guest room. He could not bear to sleep in the bed he had shared with Diana. Sleepless with grief and depression, aware that he was edging closer and closer to just giving up and pulling the pin. He would have called such an action cowardly only weeks before, but had since come to recognize several undeniable facts. The pain would not stop. The grief would not stop. And of course, his life was not apt to be a long one in any case. You only had to smell the decaying animals in the woods to know what lay ahead. He'd heard rattling sounds, and at first thought it might be a human being, or a surviving bear that had smelled his food. But the Jenny was still running then, and in the glare of the motion lights that illuminated the driveway, he had seen a little gray dog alternately scratching at the door and then huddling on the porch. When Robinson opened the door, the dog at first backed away, ears back and tail tucked. "I guess you better come in," Robinson had said, and without much further hesitation, the dog did. Robinson gave him a bowl of water, which he lapped furiously, and then a can of Prudence corned beef hash, which he ate in 5 or 6 snaffling bites. When the dog finished, Robinson stroked him, hoping he wouldn't be bitten. Instead of biting, the dog licked his hand. "You're Gandalf," Robinson had said. "Gandalf the Grey," and then burst into tears. He tried to tell himself he was being ridiculous, but he wasn't. He was no longer alone in the house.
"What news about that motor huckle of yours?" Timlin asked. They had progressed to their second beers. When Robinson finished his, he and Gandalf would make the 2-mile walk back to the house. He didn't want to wait too long. The mosquitoes got thicker when twilight came. If Timlin's right, he thought, the bloodsuckers will inherit the earth instead of the meek, if they can find any blood to suck, that is. "The battery's dead," he told Timlin. "Then, my wife made me promise to sell the bike when I was 50. She said after 50 a man's reflexes are too slow to be safe." "And you're 50 when?"
"Next year," Robinson said, and he laughed at the absurdity of it.
"I lost a tooth this morning," Timlin said. "Might mean nothing at my age, but..."
"Seeing any blood in the toilet bowl?" Timlin had told him that was one of the first signs of advanced radiation poisoning, and he knew a lot more about it than Robinson did. What Robinson knew was that his wife and daughter had been in Boston when the frantic Geneva peace talks had gone up in a nuclear flash on the 5th of June, and they were still in Boston the next day when the world killed itself. The eastern seaboard of America, from Hartford to Miami, was now mostly slag.
"I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment on that," Timlin said. "Here comes your dog. Better check his paws, he's limping a bit. Looks like the rear left."
But they could find no thorn in any of Gandalf's paws, and this time, when Timlin pulled gently at his fur, a patch on his hindquarters came out. Gandalf seemed not to feel it. The two men looked at each other.
"Could be the mange," Robinson said at last. "Or stress. Dogs do lose fur when they're stressed, you know."
"Maybe."
Timlin was looking west across the lake.
"It's going to be a beautiful sunset. Of course, they're all beautiful now. Like when Krakatoa blew its stack in 1883. Only this was 10,000 Krakatoas." He bent and stroked Gandalf's head.
"India and Pakistan," Robinson said. Timlin straightened up again.
"Well, yes, but then everyone else just had to get into the act, didn't they? Even the Chechens had a few, which they delivered to Moscow in pickup trucks. It's as though the world willfully forgot how many countries and groups, fucking groups, had those things."
"Or what those things were capable of," Robinson said. Timlin nodded.
"That too. We were too worried about the debt ceiling, and our friends across the pond were concentrating on stopping child beauty pageants and propping up the euro."
"You're sure Canada's just as dirty as the lower 48?
"It's a matter of degree, I suppose. Vermont's not as dirty as New York, and Canada's probably not as dirty as Vermont, but it will be. Plus, most of the people headed up there are already sick. Sick unto death, if I may misquote Kierkegaard. Want another beer?"
"I'd better get back," Robinson stood. "Come on, Gandalf. Time to burn some calories."
"Will I see you tomorrow?"
"Maybe in the late afternoon. I've got an errand to run in the morning."
"May I ask where?"
"Bennington. Well, there's still enough gas in my truck to get there and back." Timlin raised his eyebrows. "Want to see if I can find a motorcycle battery." Gandalf made it as far as Dead Man's Curve under his own power, although his limp grew steadily worse. When they got there, he simply sat down, as if to watch the boiling sunset reflected in the lake. It was a fuming orange, shot through with arteries of deepest red. The dog whined and licked at his back left leg. Robinson sat beside him for a little while, but when the first mosquito scouts called for reinforcements, he picked Gandalf up and started walking again. By the time they got back to the house, Robinson's arms were trembling and his shoulders were aching. If Gandalf had weighed another 10 pounds, maybe even another 5, he would have had to leave the Mutt and go get the truck. His head also ached, perhaps from the heat, or the second beer, or both. The tree-lined driveway sloping down to the house was a pool of shadows, and the house itself was dark. The Jenny had given up the ghost weeks ago. Sunset had subsided to a dull purple bruise. He plodded onto the porch and put Gandalf down to open the door. "Go on, boy," he said. Gandalf struggled to rise, then subsided. Just as Robinson was bending to pick him up again, Gandalf made another effort. This time, he lunged over the door sill and collapsed on his side in the entryway, panting. On the wall above the dog were at least 2 dozen photographs featuring people Robinson loved, all now deceased. He could no longer even dial Diana's and Ellen's phones and listen to their recorded voices. His own phone had died shortly after the generator, but even before that, all cell service had ceased. He got a bottle of Poland Spring water from the pantry, filled Gandalf's bowl, then put down a scoop of kibble. Gandalf drank some water, but wouldn't eat. When Robinson squatted to scratch the dog's belly, fur came out in bundles. "It's happening so fast," he thought. "This morning he was fine." Robinson went out to the lean-to behind the house with a flashlight. On the lake, a loon cried, just one. The motorcycle was under a tarp. He pulled the canvas off and shone the beam along the bike's gleaming body. It was a 2014 Fat Bob, several years old now, but low mileage. His days of riding 4,000 and 5,000 miles between May and October were behind him. Yet the Bob was still his dream ride, even though his dreams were mostly where he'd ridden it over the last couple of years. Air-cooled, twin cam, 6-speed, almost 1,700 cc's, and the sound it made. Only Harleys had that sound, like summer thunder. When you came up next to a Chevy at a stoplight, the cager inside was apt to lock his doors. Robinson skidded a palm along the handlebars, then hoisted his leg over and sat in the saddle with his feet on the pegs. Diana had become increasingly insistent that he sell it, and when he did ride, she reminded him again and again that Vermont had a helmet law for a reason, unlike the idiots in New Hampshire and Maine. Now he could ride it without a helmet if he wanted to. There was no Diana to nag him, and no county mounties to pull him over. He could ride it buck-ass naked if he wanted to. "Although I'd have to mind the tailpipes when I got off," he said, and laughed. He went inside without putting the tarp back on the Harley. Gandalf was lying on the bed of blankets Robinson had made for him, nose on one of his front paws. His kibble was untouched. "Better eat up," Robinson said, giving Gandalf's head a stroke. "You'll feel better." The next morning there was a red stain on the blankets around Gandalf's hindquarters, and although he tried, he couldn't make it to his feet. After he gave up the second time, Robinson carried him outside, where Gandalf first lay on the grass, then managed to get up enough to squat. What came out of him was a gush of bloody stool. Gandalf crawled away from it as if ashamed, then lay down, looking at Robinson mournfully. This time when Robinson picked him up, Gandalf cried out in pain. He bared his teeth but did not bite. Robinson carried him into the house and put him down on his blanket bed. He looked at his hands when he straightened up and saw they were coated with fur. When he dusted his palms together, the fur floated away like milkweed. "You'll be okay," he told Gandalf. "Just a little upset stomach. Must have gotten one of those goddamn chipmunks when I wasn't looking. Stay there and rest up. I'm sure you'll be feeling more like yourself by the time I get back." There was still half a tank of gas in the Silverado, more than enough for a 60-mile round trip to Bennington. Robinson decided to go down to Woodland Acres first and see if Timlin wanted anything. His last neighbor was sitting on the porch of Veronica and his rocker. He was extremely pale, and there were purple pouches under his eyes. When Robinson told him about Gandalf, Timlin nodded.
"I was up most of the night, running to the toilet.
We must have caught the same bug. He smiled to show it was a joke, although not a very funny one. No, he said, there was nothing he wanted in Bennington, but perhaps Robinson would stop by on his way back. I've got something you might want, he said.
The drive to Bennington was slower than Robinson expected because the highway was littered with abandoned cars. It was close to noon by the time he pulled into the front lot of Kingdom Harley-Davidson. The show windows had been broken and all the display models were gone, but there were plenty of bikes out back. These had been rendered theft-proof with steel cables sheathed in plastic and sturdy bike locks. That was fine with Robinson. He only wanted to steal a battery. The fat bob he settled on was a year or two newer than his, but the battery looked the same. He fetched his toolbox from the bed of his pickup and checked the battery with his impact. The tester had been a gift from his daughter 2 birthdays back, and got a green light. He removed the battery, went into the showroom, and found a selection of maps. Using the most detailed one to suss out the back roads, he made it back to the lake by 3 o'clock. He saw a great many dead animals, including an extremely large moose lying beside the cement block steps of someone's trailer home. On the trailer's crabgrassy lawn, a hand-painted sign had been posted. Only 2 words, heaven soon. The porch of Veronica was deserted, but when Robinson knocked on the door, Timlin called for him to come in. He was sitting in the ostentatiously rustic living room, paler than ever. In one hand, he held an oversized linen napkin. It was spotted with blood. On the coffee table in front of him were 3 items, a picture book titled The Beauty of Vermont, a hypodermic needle filled with yellow fluid, and a revolver. I'm glad you came, Timlin said. I didn't want to leave without telling you goodbye. Robinson recognized the absurdity of the first response that came to mind, let's not be hasty, and stayed silent.
I've lost 6 teeth, Timlin said, but that's not the major problem. In the last 12 hours or so, I seem to have expelled most of my intestines. The eerie thing is how little it hurts. The hemorrhoids I was afflicted with in my 50s were worse. The pain will come. I've read enough to know that, but I don't intend to stick around long enough to experience it in full flower. Did you get the battery you wanted?
Yes, Robinson said, and sat down heavily. Jesus, Howard, I'm so fucking sorry.
Much appreciated. And you? How do you feel?
Physically? Fine. Although this was no longer completely true. Several red patches that didn't look like sunburn were blooming on his forearms, and there was another on his chest above the right nipple. They itched. Also, his breakfast was staying down, but his stomach seemed far from happy with it. Timlin leaned forward and tapped the hypo.
Demerol, I was going to inject myself and look at pictures of Vermont until. But I've changed my mind. The gun will be fine, I think. You take the hypo.
I'm not quite ready.
Not for you. For the dog. He doesn't deserve to suffer. It wasn't dogs that built the bombs, after all.
I think maybe he just ate a chipmunk, Robinson said feebly.
We both know that's not it. Even if it was, the dead animals are so full of radiation it might as well have been a cobalt capsule. It's a wonder he's survived as long as he has. Be grateful for the time you've had with him. A little bit of grace. That's what a good dog is, you know. A little bit of grace.
Timlin studied him closely.
Don't you cry on me. If you do, I will too, so man up. There's 1 more 6-pack of Bud in the fridge. I don't know why I bothered to put it in there, but old habits die hard. Why don't you bring us each one? Warm beer is better than no beer. I believe Woodrow Wilson said that. We'll toast Gandalf. Also your new motorcycle battery. Meanwhile, I need to spend a penny. Or who knows, this one might cost a little more.
Robinson got the beer. When he came back, Timlin was gone and remained gone for almost 5 minutes. He came back slowly, holding on to things. He had removed his pants and cinched a bath sheet around his midsection.